This is a Brain Channel program from the Department of Neurosciences at the UC San Diego School of Medicine. Visit us at uctv.tv/brain to explore cutting-edge research, treatment options for conditions related to the nervous system, and the inner workings of the human mind.
Greetings, Bill Mobley for the Brain Channel on UCTV. I'm very excited and very happy to have with me Dr. Doris Trauner, who is a distinguished professor of neurosciences and pediatrics at UCSD. Doris has committed a large fraction of her career to understanding the biology of autism and for caring for patients with autism and for supporting their families. Doris is a longtime colleague at UCSD and has truly a distinguished career. Doris, we're glad to have you with us.
Thank you.
I thought we might start by talking about autism as it's seen by the family and by the doctors that they first consult. Do you want to tell us a little bit about autism at that level?
Yeah, so autism is a neurodevelopmental disorder, first of all. It's something changes in the way the brain develops, and it causes the symptoms and signs that we call autism or autism spectrum. And there are really just a few core features that distinguish autism and make the diagnosis likely. And those include defects in communication, so lack of reciprocal communication, lack of the ability to actually carry on a conversation with somebody else and have that give and take kind of conversation. The second is deficits in language. So actually being able to use language properly to communicate. And then the third is restricted range of behaviors and repetitive stereotypic behaviors. And so it's actually a very straightforward list of clinical criteria for autism. But then there are all of these extended issues that go along with the core features of autism that are not part of the core, but we see them so often that they really could be. The vast majority of children with autism have sleep problems. In fact, many times that's why they come to me, is because the children aren't sleeping. They have sensory issues. They have real difficulties with textures, with taste, with smell. They often will only eat a very limited number of foods or a certain texture of food. And then there are so many other things. Seizures are associated with autism in a high percentage of patients. But what the parents see is generally a young child, usually between the ages of 12 and 24 months, who seems to not be communicating as well as they should, not speaking, not saying words, not pointing, not indicating their wants, and often with reduced eye contact. And those are the first things usually the parents will see. And then after that, they'll notice these repetitive behaviors with hand flapping or spinning around or other kinds of stereotypic behaviors. And they usually come to the attention of a professional sometime between the ages of 1 and 3, usually. But often the diagnosis is delayed until the age of 4, and that's really unfortunate.
Let me ask this question. When parents come to you, do they portray a child that was normal until, let's say, age 12 months? Or do they say, well, they weren't really normal from the beginning? What do you hear from the parents? Do they detect something early, or is this really an emergence of abnormal function?
Most parents, at least in my experience, don't often detect something abnormal before the end of the first year of life. Mm-hmm. In retrospect, sometimes often they'll say, oh, he was a quiet baby. He really didn't need to be held very much. He was so easy. And if you think about that in the context of autism, perhaps it's because the baby really didn't care about other companionship, and so they were content to lie in their crib or their swing or whatever, and not fuss. But the parents don't see it that way. Mm. They see the baby as an easy baby, maybe a baby who didn't want to take the breast. Very often I'll hear that it was difficult to breastfeed, so they went to bottle feeding. And then there are a few other things that are subtle things, but most of the time the parents don't say, I thought something was wrong, you know, at 5 months of age or something like that.
So this is an emergence of a collection of different changes in behavior that ultimately say to the parents, we need help with this, we need somebody. Who do they see first?
They generally talk to their pediatrician first.
Yeah.
And depending on the pediatrician, they get a different response. Most pediatricians now are very aware of doing the MCHAT, which is a brief questionnaire to identify potential autistic features. And then the pediatrician may refer them on to either a speech pathologist or a psychologist for testing, and that's often what happens.
Mm-hmm.
We do get into a little bit of a dilemma in that a lot of psychologists have been trained to not make a diagnosis of autism until the age of 3.
Mm.
And we know that we can make a diagnosis of autism well before that. Mm. But if the parent is told that, then often there are delays in getting a diagnosis and getting treatment.
The right diagnosis, the right kind of intervention, it sounds like, is with a child neurologist, somebody who, or a child psychiatrist, somebody who really sees this disorder, understands the disorder, and then evaluates patients. What would you say is the average age at which a child would have a referral to you?
Probably the average age is about 3.
Yeah.
But I have seen children as young as about 14 months.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, 5, 6, 8 years old who've never been diagnosed.
Right. So the imperative would be to get to somebody who studies developmental disorders of the brain as soon as possible.
Correct.
For these kids.
Correct.
And then when you see them, what do you do? What's your evaluation look like?
For me, and I specialize in neurodevelopmental disabilities, so I do my assessment from that that standpoint, what is going on neurodevelopmentally. So I look at the child's developmental status in terms of his brain function. And I say his because the vast majority of autistic children are boys, 4-to-1 roughly, boys to girls. Obviously, there are many girls with autism too. But when I see a child where usually the parents will bring the child in and say that my child's not talking, my child is not really wanting to play with other children, I will look at their developmental milestones, motor, sensory, and language. I'll look at their behavior. I'll ask about things like sleeping, eating, what kinds of toys they like to play with, how they interact with other children, how they interact with their siblings, how they interact with their parents. I think one of the mistakes that people make is thinking that autistic children don't interact with anybody, and therefore if the child's playing with his or her siblings, then they can't be autistic, and that's just not the case. Most autistic children have some interaction with their siblings and certainly with their parents. And so that does not rule out autism. But I ask about all of those things, and then I examine the child, and my exam really is focused on interaction. So I have toys, and I will show the child the toys and see what they do with them, see if they take the toys, see how they play with them, see if they look at their parents to share the toys with them, social referencing, which is very important and which autistic children lack. See if they look at me to see if it's okay if they can play with the toys. And we do some different things with toys. I look at their eye contact, their social interaction, their referencing, their nonverbal communication. So many times a child with autism will be overly friendly, and they'll come and want to sit on my lap, and I'm a stranger to them. They should not want to sit on my lap. But that is another example of inappropriate social interaction. So I look at all of those things, I try to assess their language. Do they understand what I'm asking them to do? So is their receptive language good? Then I look at their expressive language. Can they name things? Can they point to body parts? Mm-hmm. Can they point at all? And so most of my exam is really focused on that. And then, of course, I do a standard neurological exam. Many children with autism have motor delays as well. They have low muscle tone. They have fine motor deficits, so they may be very awkward at stacking blocks or at scribbling with a pen or something like that.
So really, it's a it's a list of changes in brain function. It's a series of changes in brain function that are not just social. It's more generally affecting the brain.
Right.
So you finished your evaluation, your physical exam, and your history taking. What happens next?
Generally, I have a long chat with the parents. If I think the child has an autism spectrum disorder, what I will tell them is there are many causes of autism. And autism really isn't a diagnosis. It's a description of a constellation of symptoms that can be caused by many different things. We know a lot of the causes. But for many children, we don't know the cause for that particular child. But we do know that there are many genetic causes. There are many inborn errors of metabolism that can cause autism. There are other things like premature birth that predispose to a higher incidence of autism. Very early brain infections, especially intrauterine viral infections like rubella, and toxoplasmosis can cause autism. So what I do is go over the fact that there are many possible causes, that it's important to look for potential causes for a couple of reasons. One is some of those might be treatable, and obviously if there's something that might be treatable, we want to find out about it. The second is that even if it's not treatable, having a diagnosis can help with prognosis and also with helping to determine the best course of action for intervention for those children. And then the third reason is for genetic counseling. If the parents are thinking about having other children, or if they have other children who might be carriers of a gene that might make them susceptible to having children with autism, it's important for the family to know.
So there's a lot that goes on between you and the family, and you're informing them about multiple causes. You're saying that those causes should be sought if they can be diagnosed, and you're encouraging early intervention to try to help the brain grow.
Right.
That's an exciting situation to be in, because you're actually delivering new information, and my guess is that the average family is pleased to know that at least somebody who's skilled has finally come to their aid.
Yes.
What's the experience that you've had with families when they hear your description of what's going on, and that you think this child may be fit into the autism spectrum?
I think most parents suspect it by the time they bring the child to me. Mm-hmm. I think they're relieved to get a diagnosis, and I think they're very relieved to get a relatively comprehensive explanation for the things that that it might be caused by, the fact that maybe we won't find out what the cause for their child is, but we need to look. And also that there are interventions that can help. And the earlier, the better. That's the one of the things we do know is that the earlier intervention starts, the better the outcome for the child.
What interventions do you recommend?
So it's a multi-pronged approach for treating autism. Earliest and proven effective intervention is behavioral intervention, ABA, applied behavioral analysis, and variants of that. But they're all behavioral interventions that are very detailed. They're intensive, up to 40 hours a week sometimes, and one-on-one with the child and the therapist, and they help. In the vast majority of cases, children can make huge strides with ABA, and that's usually the first thing I recommend. In a child who's younger than about two, and again, we really hope to get them a lot younger than that if they're one-year-old. Sometimes it's thought that ABA, they're too young for ABA, but there's a treatment called floor time therapy that is more naturalistic, play-based therapy, where the therapist literally sits on the floor with the child and plays with toys, but directs them in ways that will improve social interaction and interchange. And that I've referred babies as young as 10 months for fourth floor time with great success. So you can start behavioral therapy very early, and then educational therapy, the right kind of preschool placement is really important. And then, of course, if we identify a specific cause that might need treatment, then that might be some sort of cofactor replacement if there's a metabolic disorder or something like that. And then the final thing that we can do is medication. And not every child should be given medication, but there are many children with autism who benefit tremendously from medication, and it can change their trajectory. If you have a 2 or 3 year old who is so hyperactive, and we do have a lot of children with autism who are so hyperactive that they cannot, their bodies just can't stay focused long enough to learn anything. When they're treated appropriately and that hyperactivity is harnessed, those children can start to learn and their language can improve. And I have seen so many children who have made rapid improvements with medication at a young age. And so it can make a difference. Again, not for everybody, but for some children who have certain kinds of symptoms that are holding them back. With all of those multi-pronged approaches, we can make a big difference in the outcome.
It sounds like you really are making a difference. And so even though this disorder is on people's minds and it's a concern to parents with a child that's not speaking or having some problem, the good news is the right evaluation and the right intervention can make a big difference.
Right.
Thanks for being on the program.
Thank you.
Bill Mobley for The Brain Channel.